The pamphlet literature of 16th century Europe groaned with the denunciations of wholesale adulteration of food and other products. Man has never reconciled himself to the Ten Commandments. We have seen Voltaire's view of history as mainly a collection of the crimes, follies, and misfortunes of mankind, and Gibbon's echo of that summary. We must remind ourselves again that history, as usually written, peccavimus, is quite different from history as usually lived. The historian records the exceptional because it is interesting, because it is exceptional. If all those individuals who had no Boswell had found their numerically proportionate place in the pages of historians, we should have a duller but juster view of the past and of man. Behind the red facade of war and politics, misfortune and poverty, adultery and divorce, murder and suicide, were millions of orderly homes, devoted marriages, men and women kindly and affectionate, troubled and happy with children. Even in recorded history, we find so many instances of goodness, even of nobility, that we can forgive, though not forget, the sins. The gifts of charity have almost equaled the cruelty of battlefields and jails. How many times, even in our sketchy narratives, we have seen men helping one another. Farinelli providing for the children of Domenico Scarlatti. Diverse people succoring young Haydn. Cantalita playing for Johann Christian Bach's studies at Bologna. Joseph Black advancing money repeatedly to James Watt. Puchberg patiently lending and lending to Mozart. Who will dare to write a history of human goodness? So we cannot be sure that the moral laxity of our times is a herald of decay, rather than a painful or delightful transition between a moral code that has lost its agricultural basis and another that our industrial civilization has yet to forge into social order and normality. Meanwhile, history assures us that civilizations decay quite leisurely. For 250 years after moral weakening began in Greece with the Sophists, Hellenic civilization continued to produce masterpieces of literature and art. Roman morals began to, quote, decay, end quote, soon after the conquered Greeks passed into Italy, 146 B.C. But Rome continued to have great statesmen, philosophers, poets, and artists until the death of Marcus Aurelius, A.D. 180. Politically, Rome was at nadir when Caesar came, 60 B.C., and yet it did not quite succumb to the barbarians till A.D. 465. May we take as long to fall as did Imperial Rome. Perhaps discipline will be restored in our civilization through the military training required by the challenges of war. The freedom of the part varies with the security of the whole. Individualism will diminish in America and England as geographical protection ceases. Sexual license may cure itself through its own excess. Our unmoored children may live to see order and modesty become fashionable. Clothing will be more stimulating than nudity. Meanwhile, much of our moral freedom is good. It is pleasant to be relieved of theological terrors, to enjoy without qualm the pleasures that harm neither others nor ourselves, and to feel the tang of the open air upon our liberated flesh. Chapter 7. Religion and History. Even the skeptical historian develops a humble respect for religion, since he sees it functioning and seemingly indispensable in every land and age. To the unhappy, the suffering, the bereaved, the old, it has brought supernatural comforts valued by millions of souls as more precious than any natural aid. It has helped parents and teachers to discipline the young. It has conferred meaning and dignity upon the lowliest existence, and through its sacraments has made for stability by transforming human covenants into solemn relationships with God. It has kept the poor, said Napoleon, from murdering the rich. For since the natural inequality of men dooms many of us to poverty or defeat, some supernatural hope may be the sole alternative to despair. Destroy that hope, and class war is intensified. Heaven and utopia are buckets in a well. When one goes down, the other goes up. When religion declines, communism grows. Religion does not seem at first to have had any connection with morals. Apparently, for we are merely guessing or echoing Petronius, who echoed Lucretius, quote, "It was fear that first made the gods," end quote. Fear of hidden forces in the earth, rivers, oceans, trees, winds, and sky. Religion became the propitiatory worship of these forces through offerings, sacrifice, incantation, and prayer. Only when priests used these fears and rituals to support morality and law did religion become a force vital and rival to the state. It told the people that the local code of morals and laws had been dictated by the gods. It pictured the god Thoth giving laws to Menes for Egypt, the god Shamash giving Hammurabi a code for Babylonia, Yahweh giving the Ten Commandments and 613 precepts to Moses for the Jews, and the divine nymph Egeria giving Numa Pompilius laws for Rome. Pagan cults and Christian creeds proclaimed that earthly rulers were appointed and protected by the gods. Gratefully, nearly every state shared its lands and revenues with the priests. Some recusants have doubted that religion ever promoted morality, since immorality has flourished even in the ages of religious domination. Certainly, sensuality, drunkenness, coarseness, greed, dishonesty, robbery, and violence existed in the Middle Ages, but probably the moral disorder born of half a millennium of barbarian invasion, war, economic devastation, and political disorganization would have been much worse without the moderating effect of the Christian ethic, priestly exhortations, saintly exemplars, and a calming, unifying ritual. The Roman Catholic Church labored to reduce slavery, family feuds, and national strife, to extend the intervals of truce and peace, and to replace trial by combat or ordeal with the judgments of established courts. It softened the penalties exacted by Roman or barbarian law and vastly expanded the scope and organization of charity. Though the Church served the state, it claimed to stand above all states, as morality should stand above power. It taught men that patriotism, unchecked by a higher loyalty, can be a tool of greed and crime. Over all the competing governments of Christendom, it promulgated one moral law. Claiming divine origin and spiritual hegemony, the Church offered itself as an international court to which all rulers were to be morally responsible. The Emperor Henry IV recognized this claim by submitting to Pope Gregory VII at Canossa, 1077. And a century later, Innocent III raised the authority and prestige of the papacy to a height where it seemed that Gregory's ideal of a moral superstate had come to fulfillment. The majestic dream broke under the attacks of nationalism, skepticism, and human frailty. The Church was manned with men who often proved biased, venal, or extortionate. France grew in wealth and power and made the papacy her political tool. Kings became strong enough to compel a pope to dissolve that Jesuit order which had so devotedly supported the popes. The Church stooped to fraud, as with pious legends, bogus relics, and dubious miracles. For centuries, it profited from a mythical donation of Constantine that had allegedly bequeathed Western Europe to Pope Sylvester I, who reigned from 314 to 335, and from false decretals, approximately 842, that forged a series of documents to give a sacred antiquity to papal omnipotence. More and more, the hierarchy spent its energies in promoting orthodoxy rather than morality, and the Inquisition almost fatally disgraced the Church. Even while preaching peace, the Church fomented religious wars in 16th century France and the Thirty Years' War in 17th century Germany. It played only a modest part in the outstanding advance of modern morality, the abolition of slavery. It allowed the philosophers to take the lead in the humanitarian movements that have alleviated the evils of our time. History has justified the Church in the belief that the masses of mankind desire a religion rich in miracle, mystery, and myth. Some minor modifications may have been allowed in ritual, in ecclesiastical costume, and in episcopal authority, but the Church dares not alter the doctrines that reason smiles at, for such changes would offend and disillusion the millions whose hopes have been tied to inspiring and consolatory imaginations. No reconciliation is possible between religion and philosophy except through the philosophers' recognition that they have found no substitute for the moral function of the Church and the ecclesiastical recognition of religious and intellectual freedom. Does history support a belief in God? If by God we mean not the creative vitality of nature, but a supreme being intelligent and benevolent, the answer must be a reluctant negative. Like other departments of biology, history remains at bottom a natural selection of the fittest individuals and groups in a struggle wherein goodness receives no favors, misfortunes abound, and the final test is the ability to survive. Add to the crimes, wars, and cruelties of man the earthquakes, storms, tornadoes, pestilences, tidal waves, and other, quote, acts of God, end quote, that periodically desolate human and animal life, and the total evidence suggests either a blind or an impartial fatality, with incidental and apparently haphazard scenes to which we subjectively ascribe order, splendor, beauty, or sublimity. If history supports any theology, this would be a dualism, like the Zoroastrian or Manichaean, a good spirit and an evil spirit battling for control of the universe and men's souls. These faiths and Christianity, which is essentially Manichaean, assured their followers that the good spirit would win in the end. But of this consummation, history offers no guarantee. Nature and history do not agree with our conceptions of good and bad. They define good as that which survives, and bad as that which goes under. And the universe has no prejudice in favor of Christ as against Genghis Khan. The growing awareness of man's minuscule place in the cosmos has furthered the impairment of religious belief. In Christendom, we may date the beginning of the decline from Copernicus, 1543. The process was slow, but by 1611, John Donne was mourning that the earth had become a mere suburb in the world, and that, quote, new philosophy calls all in doubt, end quote. And Francis Bacon, while tipping his hat occasionally to the bishops, was proclaiming science as the religion of modern emancipated man. In that generation began, quote, the death of God, end quote, as an external deity. So great an effect required many causes besides the spread of science and historical knowledge. First, the Protestant Reformation, which originally defended private judgment. Then, the multitude of Protestant sects and conflicting theologies, each appealing to both scriptures and reason. Then, the higher criticism of the Bible, displaying that marvelous library as the imperfect work of fallible men. Then, the deistic movement in England, reducing religion to a vague belief in a God hardly distinguishable from nature. Then, the growing acquaintance with other religions, whose myths, many of them pre-Christian, were distressingly similar to the supposedly factual basis of one's inherited creed. Then, the Protestant exposure of Catholic miracles, the deistic exposure of biblical miracles, the general exposure of frauds, inquisitions, and massacres in the history of religion. Then, the replacement of agriculture, which had stirred men to faith by the annual rebirth of life and the mystery of growth, with industry, humming daily a litany of machines and suggesting a world machine. Add, meanwhile, the bold advance of skeptical scholarship, as in Bale, and of pantheistic philosophy, as in Spinoza, the massive attack of the French Enlightenment upon Christianity, the revolt of Paris against the Church during the French Revolution, Add, in our own time, the indiscriminate slaughter of civilian populations in modern war. Finally, the awesome triumphs of scientific technology, promising men omnipotence and destruction, and challenging the divine command of the skies. In one way, Christianity lent a hand against itself by developing in many Christians a moral sense that could no longer stomach the vengeful God of the traditional theology. The idea of a hell disappeared from educated thought, even from pulpit homilies. Presbyterians became ashamed of the Westminster Confession, which had pledged them to a belief in a God who had created billions of men and women, despite his foreknowledge that, regardless of their virtues and crimes, they were predestined to everlasting hell. Educated Christians visiting the Sistine Chapel were shocked by Michelangelo's picture of Christ hurling offenders pell-mell into an inferno whose fires were never to be extinguished. Was this the, quote, gentle Jesus, meek and mild, end quote, who had inspired our youth? Just as the moral development of the Hellenes had weakened their belief in the quarrelsome and adulterous deities of Olympus, a certain proportion of mankind, wrote Plato, did not believe at all in the existence of the gods. So, the development of the Christian ethic slowly eroded Christian theology. Christ destroyed Jehovah. The replacement of Christian with secular institutions is the culminating and critical result of the Industrial Revolution. That states should attempt to dispense with theological supports is one of the many crucial experiments that bewilder our brains and unsettle our ways today. Laws which were once presented as the decrees of a God-given king are now, frankly, the confused commands of fallible men. Education, which was the sacred province of God-inspired priests, becomes the task of men and women shorn of theological robes and awe, and relying on reason and persuasion to civilize young rebels who fear only the policeman and may never learn to reason at all. Colleges, once allied to churches, have been captured by businessmen and scientists. The propaganda of patriotism, capitalism, or communism succeeds to the inculcation of a supernatural creed and moral code. Holy days give way to holidays. Theaters are full even on Sundays. And even on Sundays, churches are half empty. In Anglo-Saxon families, religion has become a social observance and protective coloration. In American Catholic families, it flourishes. In upper and middle class France and Italy, religion is, quote, a secondary sexual characteristic of the female, end quote. 1,000 signs proclaim that Christianity is undergoing the same decline that fell upon the old Greek religion after the coming of the Sophists and the Greek Enlightenment. Catholicism survives because it appeals to the imagination, hope, and the senses, because its mythology consoles and brightens the lives of the poor, and because the commanded fertility of the faithful slowly regains the lands lost to the Reformation. Catholicism has sacrificed the adherence of the intellectual community and suffers increasing defections through contact with secular education and literature, but it wins converts from souls wearied with the uncertainty of reason, and from others hopeful that the church will stem internal disorder and the communist wave. If another great war should devastate Western civilization, the resultant destruction of cities, the dissemination of poverty, and the disgrace of science may leave the church, as in AD 476, the sole hope and guide of those who survive the cataclysm. One lesson of history is that religion has many lives, and a habit of resurrection. How often in the past have God and religion died and been reborn? Akhenaten used all the powers of a pharaoh to destroy the religion of Amun. Within a year of Akhenaten's death, the religion of Amun was restored. Atheism ran wild in the India of Buddha's youth, and Buddha himself founded a religion without a god. After his death, Buddhism developed a complex theology including gods, saints, and hell. Philosophy, science, and education depopulated the Hellenic pantheon, but the vacuum attracted a dozen Oriental faiths, rich in resurrection myths. In 1793, Hébert and Chaumette, wrongly interpreting Voltaire, established in Paris the atheistic worship of the goddess of reason. A year later, Robespierre, fearing chaos and inspired by Rousseau, set up the worship of the Supreme Being. In 1801, Napoleon, versed in history, signed a concordat with Pius VII, restoring the Catholic Church in France. The irreligion of 18th-century England disappeared under the Victorian Compromise with Christianity. The state agreed to support the Anglican Church, and the educated classes would muffle their skepticism on the tacit understanding that the church would accept subordination to the state, and the parson would humbly serve the squire. In America, the rationalism of the founding fathers gave place to a religious revival in the 19th century. Puritanism and paganism, the repression and the expression of the senses and desires, alternate in mutual reaction in history. Generally, religion and Puritanism prevail in periods when the laws are feeble and morals must bear the burden of maintaining social order. Skepticism and paganism, other factors being equal, progress as the rising power of law and government permits the decline of the church, the family, and morality, without basically endangering the stability of the state. In our time, the strength of the state has united with the several forces listed above to relax faith and morals and to allow paganism to resume its natural sway. Probably our excesses will bring another reaction. Moral disorder may generate a religious revival. Atheists may again, as in France after the debacle of 1870, send their children to Catholic schools to give them the discipline of religious belief. Hear the appeal of the agnostic Renan in 1866. Quote, "Let us enjoy the liberty of the sons of God, but let us take care lest we become accomplices in the diminution of virtue, which would menace society if Christianity were to grow weak. What should we do without it? If rationalism wishes to govern the world without regard to the religious needs of the soul, the experience of the French Revolution is there to teach us the consequences of such a blunder." End quote. Does history warrant Renan's conclusion that religion is necessary to morality? That a natural ethic is too weak to withstand the savagery that lurks under the civilization and emerges in our dreams, crimes, and wars? Joseph de Maistre answered, quote, "I do not know what the heart of a rascal may be. I know what is in the heart of an honest man. It is horrible." End quote. There is no significant example in history before our time of a society successfully maintaining moral life without the aid of religion. France, the United States, and some other nations have divorced their governments from all churches, but they have had the help of religion in keeping social order. Only a few communist states have not merely disassociated themselves from religion, but have repudiated its aid. And perhaps the apparent and provisional success of this experiment in Russia owes much to the temporary acceptance of communism as the religion, or as skeptics would say, the opium, of the people, replacing the church as the vendor of comfort and hope. If the socialist regime should fail in its efforts to destroy relative poverty among the masses, this new religion may lose its fervor and efficacy, and the state may wink at the restoration of supernatural beliefs as an aid in quieting discontent. As long as there is poverty, there will be gods.
Chapter 8. Economics and History. History, according to Karl Marx, is economics in action. The contest among individuals, groups, classes, and states for food, fuel, materials, and economic power. Political forms, religious institutions, cultural creations are all rooted in economic realities. So, the Industrial Revolution brought with it democracy, feminism, birth control, socialism, the decline of religion, the loosening of morals, the liberation of literature from dependence upon aristocratic patronage, the replacement of Romanticism by realism in fiction, and the economic interpretation of history. The outstanding personalities in these movements were effects, not causes. Agamemnon, Achilles, and Hector would never have been heard of had not the Greeks sought commercial control of the Dardanelles. Economic ambition, not the face of Helen, quote, fairer than the evening air, clad in the beauty of a thousand stars, end quote, launched a thousand ships on Ilium. Those subtle Greeks knew how to cover naked economic truth with the fig leaf of a phrase. Unquestionably, the economic interpretation illuminates much history. The money of the Delian Confederacy built the Parthenon. The treasury of Cleopatra's Egypt revitalized the exhausted Italy of Augustus, gave Virgil an annuity, and Horace a farm. The Crusades, like the wars of Rome with Persia, were attempts of the West to capture trade routes to the East. The discovery of America was a result of the failure of the Crusades. The banking house of the Medici financed the Florentine Renaissance. The trade and industry of Nuremberg made Dura possible. The French Revolution came not because Voltaire wrote brilliant satires and Rousseau sentimental romances, but because the middle classes had risen to economic leadership, needed legislative freedom for their enterprise and trade, and itched for social acceptance and political power. Marx did not claim that individuals were always actuated by economic interest. He was far from imagining that material considerations led to Abelard's romance or the Gospel of Buddha or the poems of Keats. But perhaps he underestimated the role played by non-economic incentives in the behavior of masses, by religious fervor as in Muslim or Spanish armies, by nationalistic ardor as in Hitler's troops or Japan's kamikazes, by the self-fertilizing fury of mobs as in the Gordon riots of June 2nd through 8th, 1780 in London, or the massacres of September 2nd through 7th, 1792 in Paris. In such cases, the motives of the usually hidden leaders may be economic, but the result is largely determined by the passions of the mass. In many instances, political or military power was apparently the cause rather than the result of economic operations, as in the seizure of Russia by the Bolsheviks in 1917, or in the army coups that punctuate South American history. Who would claim that the Moorish conquest of Spain, or the Mongol conquest of Western Asia, or the Mughal conquest of India was the product of economic power? In these cases, the poor proved stronger than the rich. Military victory gave political ascendancy, which brought economic control. The generals could write a military interpretation of history. Allowing for these cautions, we may derive endless instruction from the economic analysis of the past. We observe that the invading barbarians found Rome weak because the agricultural population, which had formerly supplied the legions with hardy and patriotic warriors fighting for land, had been replaced by slaves laboring listlessly on vast farms owned by one man or a few. Today, the inability of small farms to use the best machinery profitably is again forcing agriculture into large-scale production under capitalistic or communistic ownership. It was once said that civilization is a parasite on the man with the hoe. But the man with the hoe no longer exists. He is now a hand at the wheel of a tractor or a combine. Agriculture becomes an industry. And soon the farmer must choose between being an employee of a capitalist and being the employee of a state. At the other end of the scale, history reports that the men who can manage the men who can manage only things, and the men who can manage money manage all. So the bankers, watching the trends in agriculture, industry, and trade, inviting and directing the flow of capital, putting our money doubly and trebly to work, controlling loans and interest and enterprise, running great risks to make great gains, rise to the top of the economic pyramid. From the Medici of Florence and the Fuggers of Augsburg to the Rothschilds of Paris and London and the Morgans of New York, bankers have sat in the councils of governments, financing wars and popes, and occasionally sparking a revolution. Perhaps it is one secret of their power that, having studied the fluctuations of prices, they know that history is inflationary and that money is the last thing a wise man will hoard. The experience of the past leaves little doubt that every economic system must sooner or later rely upon some form of the profit motive to stir individuals and groups to productivity. Substitutes like slavery, police supervision, or ideological enthusiasm prove too unproductive, too expensive, or too transient. Normally and generally, men are judged by their ability to produce, except in war, when they are ranked according to their ability to destroy.